Mind Web. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen. The Mind Web story this half hour is The Unfinished by Frank Belknap Long. Story copyright 1951 by Super Science Stories. This was the time we were exploring for the Larkin Museum half across the Milky Way. We had rocket trouble and had to land for repairs on a little green world 1,000 light years from home.
"We'll have to bring her down, son,"
the old one said, glancing up sharply from the navigation dial.
"It's too bad, but there's no help for it."
I gave a booming laugh of disgust, thinking of the steamy jungles which were pretty much the rule on the inner planets of Class G stars. Tall, gloomy old forests filled with rotting vegetation and vast swarms of stinging, blood-sucking insects. The old one was secretly happy about it. He liked to tramp the wild and feel the wind and rain on his face. Slowly, as I stared at him, he took on the unmistakable glow of a lad whose idea of paradise was to sit on a sun-dappled bank in the russet autumn, watching bait drift downstream and a beauty rising to his lure. He liked to explore, but was satisfied just to fish and hunt. He could take root anywhere, like a hungry mass of leaven cheated of its birthright. He was happy enough in space, but he could never quite reconcile himself to the absence of growing things in the bridge room of a rocket ship.
"It's been ages since I've lain on my back in a spruce forest staring straight up at the stars."
He grinned, a fleck of chew staining his jagged teeth.
"Ages. And I'll trade you all the shining metal of the finest rocket ship ever built for one sniff of the good, sweet earth. It's the same everywhere, on all the planets, the sea and the jungle."
"Sure, sure," I said to pacify him and keep him from bursting into song. "Sure, paradise in the palm of your hand. Now, if you'll just brace yourself and grab hold of that safety rail, I'll try to bring her down without shaking you loose from your pipe dreams." It was a smooth landing, as landings go. Down we swooped between towering walls of foliage, golden yellow and burning emerald green, the view screen at my elbow coruscating in a dazzling burst of sunlight. My hands were steady on the controls, but for a moment I felt like a badly scared giant killer swinging down from a beanstalk that would have spanned the gulfs between the stars. I really did. Star rovers are linked to the world of childhood in a great variety of ways. They see the same strange hues everywhere they turn. The light that never was shines only for them. And even an old man married 50 years could put his arm around his wife and say, "Tomorrow I'll be in deep space and your eyes will be as pretty as misty moon swimming in a sea of gold." And he could mean every word of it, too. Because in space, time seems to fall away. And your memories become the memories of youth. And you see everything as if for the first time, through absolutely unspoiled eyes. I shook off the feeling with a gesture. "Now you can let go now. We're resting at attention, but we couldn't be more firmly grounded if we were pushing up daisies." He unhooked his arm from the rail and swabbed a perspiring brow.
"You're a good pilot, son. Hey, they don't come any steadier."
I looked at him. "Well, we better go outside and check on the damage. We won't need the oxygen masks. The atmosphere reading's a bit high, but we can take that in stride." I was not unmindful of his compliments, but it confused and embarrassed me to have him turn the searchlight on my competence. Sure, I was a good pilot. Hadn't I crossed the galaxy 20 times without losing a ship? I was as proud of my record as the next man, but I saw no reason for shoulder thumping. A man needs all his self-esteem in space, but it should be accepted as something to be put on like a shining garment and worn in silence. We emerged from the vacuum port completely unarmed, carrying only a few necessary tools and expecting to be greeted by a howling wind in an empty forest clearing. We were greeted by a howling, all right, but it came from a familiar throat. and the wind that swept strong across the clearing made a moaning sound which was almost as painful to listen to. The man was down on his knees on the forest floor, howling in either rage or pain. There was a great red gash in his shoulder, and he was rolling his eyes about and slapping at the wound with his palms. Now, I don't scare easily, but the sight was so unexpected that it jolted me back on my heels. I can't speak for the old one. He seemed calm enough as he stood staring at my side, a look of serene wonder in his eyes. Serene wonder. Yes, that just about sums it up. There was an eternal, childlike quality about him I've never seen equaled in man or intelligent beast. Nothing under the wheeling stars could really scare him, for he'd mastered the knack of accepting nature in all of her moods, the worst along with the best. Even atrocious pain and death he could accept as the dark side of a very bright and wonderful coin. The wounded man was plainly a savage. He wore no clothes, and there was a metal bracelet on his right ankle which jangled as he thrashed. He was tall, sturdily built, a powerful brute of an aborigine with a look of native intelligence about him which boded ill for his enemies.
Stay where you are, son. I'll be right back.
The old one ducked quickly back inside the vacuum port, leaving me alone with the brute. I looked down at the heavy magnetic wrench in my hand, my mouth as dry as death. I had a vision of myself under savage attack, bringing the blunt weapon down on the skull of one of my fellows. The vision sickened me. The poor devil was half maddened by pain, and in my book, a savage had a moral right to strike out blindly at anything that menaced his security. In his book, I was a hostile stranger from the sky. Why, I'd be a kind of murderer, even if he attacked me. Oh, sure, I'm thin-skinned and proud of it. The Larkin Museum didn't expect me to be a colonizing brute. All they wanted were records, archaeological, anthropological, somatic, for the greater glory of science. When I was a kid, knee-high to a grasshopper, my dad used to say that a soldier of science takes 20 steps back down the ladder when he sheds blood. And I've never gotten over being the son of my father.
Has he spoken at all?
The old one asked, popping out of the port with the incredible eagerness of a yearling colt. A semantic recorder and a long roll of translating tape under his arm. He started threading the tape into the recorder without waiting for my reply, his face mirroring about 17 levels of delight.
We'll get him to talk. He'll say something, and then we'll play the tape back.
The old one isn't often wrong. But he was, for once. Apparently, the wounded aborigine just didn't want his thoughts translated by a mechanical metal box into the speech of strangers from the sky. He stood up and glared at us for a second or two, his eyes smoldering with emotions as old as man. Sure, boy, I thought, sure. Yeah, we've caught you at a bad moment with your hair down. You have your pride. I must have guessed what he was thinking, for he suddenly drew himself up as though in fierce pride and stood at his full height, the wound gleaming in his flesh like some great crimson medal won for valor beyond the call of duty on a battlefield the jungle could never claim. The man spirit can be a pretty fine and plucky thing when it doesn't try to conceal the grievousness of its wounds. And I admired that savage for all the things we had in common, and the milestones we still must pass.
He'll say something now. He's going to speak.
I never saw man or beast turn quite as fast as that savage. One minute he was facing us in the sunlight, as still as a subcritical mass getting set for an atomic explosion. The next he was plunging furiously away from us through the underbrush, a cloud of buzzing insects in his wake. The old one had a shining gift for understatement when frustration gnawed at him.
Well, now,
was all he said. The magnificent savage was gone, and we were alone again in a clearing so still you could have heard a gnat pullulating. But I didn't let it throw me. Getting the ship repaired came first. That was the big, important job anyway. I took the old one by the arm and hurried him toward the stern rocket tubes. We got to work fast, I told him. If he comes back with his tribe, they'll take it for granted that we wounded him.
Why do savages shift guilt around like that? It seems like most savages simply work off their rage on the first stranger they meet, innocent or guilty.
Well, it works for a rough kind of justice in the long run. At some time in their lives, most of us are guilty. If they become careless, too, they deserve what they get. The damage wasn't too bad. Oh, it's an hour's job if we work our heads off. Maybe I'm an alarmist, but I think we should try to whittle that estimate down a bit.
Just as you say, son.
The old one grinned and stripped off his weather jacket. That was the best thing about him. He could talk himself into a blue funk, but when a job really looked tough, he became as solid and laconic as a square of granite. We finished the repair job in exactly 28 minutes, and we're heading back toward the vacuum port when the old one grabbed my arm.
Look!
The alien beasts were standing at the edge of a clearing in the blaze of reddening sunlight. They had emerged from the underbrush in utter silence, appearing so suddenly out of the shadows it seemed almost like a conjuring trick. In all my experience, I had never seen creatures so repulsive. For the first time in my life that I could remember, I was afraid, but I just couldn't fit them into any sane pattern of fear. Couldn't explain exactly why they made my blood run cold. The creatures walked upright and were vaguely lizard-like, but with a raw-skinned aspect of face and limb that made me repudiate the idea that they could be true reptiles. Embryonic. It's tricky, but there's a certain flabby pinkness, a blubber-mouth kind of pinkness that suggests the unformed, the monstrous. And the creatures must have possessed a fair degree of intelligence, for they wore fantastic garments and carried metal weapons. But the embryonic impression wouldn't down. You know, the shiver you get when you see something soft and pink and mottled with tadpole arms breaking water, making blubbery noises at the edge of a stagnant pool? These creatures were on dry land, were almost as large as we. But the blubbermouth feeling stayed with me. There were just two of the beasts, and they seemed to be discussing us. They made harsh, revolting noises, which sounded to the old one like intelligent speech. In 10 seconds flat, he had forgotten his surprise and disgust and was busy with a semantic recorder, his eyes shining as he edged toward them across the clearing. I moved forward to warn him, but he was deaf to all caution. He waved me back, his eyes hard with high scientific purpose. The clearing seemed suddenly bleak and lonely. We were alone with strange beasts, with dangerous beasts, 1,000 light years from green lawns and the laughter of children, from smoky fireplaces, book-lined studies, and the bright rite of friendship. One segment of my mind was alert to our danger, but the other was back in the little country town. I was walking arm in arm with the prettiest miss ever to wed a star-roving explorer and live to rue the day. The old one was 20 feet from the nearest of the beasts when their metal weapons roared. It was a brutal attack, as unexpected as it was senseless. He hadn't made a single menacing gesture. He had simply advanced across the clearing, clasping an instrument of science, his clear blue eyes wide with the innocence of his breed. In sick horror, I saw him stagger back and sink to his knees. For an instant, stark incredulity looked out of his eyes. Then he swayed and cried out to me,
Don't let him fire again. Watch out.
I can get mad fast. I went after the beasts in blind fury, not caring a hoot if I caught a weapon blast full in the face. I'd crushed underfoot a poisonous snake that struck without warning, and I had less compunction about doing the same to creatures intelligent enough to forge metal weapons. When they saw me charging at them, they dropped their weapons and went plunging into the forest. I kept right on after them, ignoring the interlacing tendrils and prickly vines which lashed and tore at my flesh. I overtook one of them, 100 feet from the clearing. I had a curious feeling of excitement as I closed in on it, my arms spread wide. Would it attempt to fight back? The eyes that bored into mine were unmistakably intelligent. Surely it knew fear for it was trembling convulsively, and it kept backing away from me as if it could not accept the reality of my nearness and the fact that it had no chance at all. Behind it, the vegetation was so densely corded that a beast twice its girth could not have broken through. It was still recoiling when my arms went around it, and I crushed it to me in a tight, unyielding embrace. Had it a spine that I could crack? Lungs which would collapse in a frothy bubbling? I was sure of nothing. I only knew that I was about to crush the life from a creature whose flesh was cold, soggy, like the flesh of a scavenger bird. Just being so close to it made me physically sick. As its repulsive cries whimpered into silence, it bobbed its head about, and I could have sworn it hissed at me, but I may have been mistaken about that. Suddenly, all my anger left me. What's the use, I thought. Let it crawl away into its lair. Let it live out its hateful life in the deep jungle. Scorpions did, or lizards, with green and vermilion poison pouches protruding from their throats. The trouble was, such lizards were beautiful to look at. This creature was as ugly as an eyeless slug. The fact that it had eyes and wore clothes and possessed intelligence of a sort didn't make it one whit less ugly. I felt disgusted. Hating an animal because nature had made it that way was as stupid as hating a worm gnawn apple or a leech-covered stone at the edge of a pond. I opened my arms wide and let the loathsome beast slip to the ground. Beasts who developed intelligence without shedding their jungle instincts had a long and unpleasant history behind them. I'd encountered such beasts before, on more worlds than I cared to remember, but never in such an evolved stage of culture. I thought of the rock-splitting birds of Spagoon, their rude flint weapons and elaborate burial customs. I remember the fire lizards of Galmar, not so named because they could pass through fire like salamanders, but because they had actually mastered the use of fire and knew how to forge iron arrowheads. Beasts, scaly, leathery, warm-blooded, a few within the weight range of man. This creature was well within the weight range of man, but I was pretty sure it had a lifespan as brief as the skunk weeds of our suburban gardens that bloom in the late autumn and die at the first touch of frost. That would mean it could never learn very much. Natural selection would eventually finish what I'd started out to do. You can thank Dame Nature for your good luck, Mr. Scorpion Eyes, I said. The beast seemed to know that it had been granted a reprieve. For it started to whimper again, and suddenly it was dragging itself away from me over the forest floor. Fighting down my revulsion, I swung about and went striding back to the clearing.
You gotta let me play the record through, son,
the old man said hours later.
You have to let me do it. I tell you, I feel all right now. I'm okay. It was just a flesh wound. What if I did lose a little blood?
We were almost in deep space, a good 5 billion miles from the Class G star sun, which warmed a worm-riddled little green butternut of a world I hoped never to see again. Worm-riddled because those creatures were on it. I thought of the savage, standing straight and proud in the sunlight, claiming his birthright despite his pain. A great throbbing wound in his side, and yet he could still draw himself up and defy us. Well, someday, that little green butternut of a world would belong to a magnificent savage with a civilizing gleam in his eyes, and he wouldn't be wearing the primitive chain bracelet on his ankle then. He'd be on his way to the stars. So the old one wanted to play the recording through, did he? He had failed to get a semantic recording of the magnificent savage's speech. All he had was worm speech from the throat of creatures who had tried to kill him. Why did he wish to inflict further torment on himself? I had no moral right to oppose him. He was an able scientist, and he had the fine childlike curiosity of his breed, and if he felt strong enough to listen to a recording of first-rate scientific importance, I had no call to put my oar in. So I said, "Now go ahead. Go ahead, who's stopping you?" He seemed a little apologetic as he turned the recorder on.
You made a fine job of bandaging up my arm, son. Don't think I'm not grateful for what you did.
Go ahead, play it. We'll give you any fun. Play it 20 times. If you want to get up and dance to it.
Don't forget, they were intelligent beasts. Their speech will translate. We'll get something more than the gibberish we heard.
Yeah, sure we will. A long string of obscenities, most likely. The old man gripped my arm.
Listen.
Eddie.
A voice spoke out of the recorder.
Eddie? Oh, no.
Hey, don't start thinking things. I see them too, and I'm not excited.
But they're wearing clothes, Eddie.
Well, sure they are. Carny clothes. What the dickens? Can't you see it's some dumb valley talker's idea of a joke?
But we haven't got three bears, Eddie. Just the bear that broke away. Just Mike Bruin, who turned ugly on us.
Well, they're from some other circus, then.
That won't wash it, Eddie. There ain't another circus within 100 miles of here. Nobody could have dressed up bears like that anyway. They're not wearing carny clothes, no. Just funny-looking jumper suits.
Oh, well, take it easy, will you? Don't get thinking things.
Who would want to get two more bears and play a joke like that on us? Be sensible, Eddie.
Well,
how would anybody know Mike Bruin would break his chain? We'd have to go hunting him with shotguns.
I'll bet you $20.
Now, look, Eddie. We go after an escaped bear on a rampage. Otherwise, he'll kill somebody and the circus will get blamed. All right, you take a pot shot at him, lose sight of him, run smack into what? Two polar bears. And behind them is a 20-ton cigar wrapped up in silver foil. And they're dressed up for a fancy costume ball or something.
Well, if you're going to start matching things.
A 20-ton silver cigar. An all-metal cigar. And the end of it looks exactly like the end of a double-barreled shotgun when you break it open. Only there are more rocket tubes than that.
Rocket tubes? Now I know you're a little ticky in the cocoa.
If that's not a spaceship...
Yeah, but they wouldn't be bears.
How do you know what Martians look like? Huh? Did you ever see a Martian?
But bears?
Look at it this way, Eddie. Maybe there are no real bears on Mars, or wherever they come from. If that was so, they wouldn't picture themselves as bears. They'd picture themselves as men. I mean, they wouldn't look like bears to themselves.
Huh? Well, then, how would they picture us?
That's what I'm worried about. How would we look to a bear? How would we look to Mike Falstaff Bruin if Mike had brains?
Well, a bear has real strength. A bear.
Flabby.
What do you mean, flabby?
The way a frog would look to us, maybe. A frog just asking to be skinned alive. I got a hunch we'd grate on a bear in more ways than the bear would grate on us. Eddie, look.
He's holding a metal cylinder. He's coming toward us with a metal cylinder in his paw.
It must be a ray gun. If we don't get them first...
A dull roar rang out in the bridge room. The clicking stopped. The old one looked at me.
Lads, oh, what is a bear?
Well, you got me.
That's what those beasts called us. Bears. They said we just look like men to ourselves.
Well, if we just look like men, we've got a lot of company. There are men like ourselves on every planet capable of supporting life in the galactic universe. Any school kid knows that parallel evolution holds good everywhere in space. That's as universal as the second law of thermodynamics.
You're right, but just suppose...
Well, it admits of no argument. See, everywhere in space, biological evolution follows the same pattern. Unicellular organisms, spiny invertebrates, amphibians, reptiles, primitive arctoid carnivora, distinguished by their massive bodies, short limbs, rudimentary tails, and then, finally, man.
Yes, sure, I know, but...
Look, did you ever see a bear? You've done a lot of star hopping in your time.
Yeah, you're right, of course. I guess it's plumb crazy. Maybe we'd better break up that recording.
Why should we do that?
I don't know. Just having it around sort of gives me the jitters.
We're going to keep it. It was utter nonsense any way you looked at it.
on one little planet, in the mighty sweep of Starfield stretching out in blazing splendor for a million light years, a loathsome little biped, fleshy pink, with no fur on its face, had said, "We just look like men to ourselves."
You know, I've been thinking how a single grain of sand dropped into a big, intricate machine can clog the works and send flywheels spinning off in all directions. Why, if that grain is hard and bright enough...
You gotta master atomic theory before you can have space flight. Now, you saw those beasts. Did they look like they had that kind of brightness inside of them? I laughed again because the old one had looked for a minute like the wilted edge of a great rug. Suddenly, he was joining me in my merriment, his voice booming out in the bridge room. Highest among the virtues of man is that supreme confidence in himself and his destiny, which can brook no rival. I stood up in majestic confidence, watching my image rise with me on the polished metal surface of the navigation dial. But it was not myself as an individual I saw. In the sturdy chest, covered with a rich matting of white fur, in the long, tapering face and deep-set eyes that smoldered with undying fires, I saw myself as the apex of a pyramid, the culmination of 5 million years of evolutionary striving. How had the poet phrased it?
Eternal man, whose name is blazoned large on all the starry void.
Unfinished, a story by Frank Belknap Long, copyright 1951 by Super Science Stories. This is Michael Hansen, technical operation for this broadcast by Bob Chan. Mind Webs is a production of WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.